Our meeting will come to order. This is an interim hearing, so there is no voting. And it's good to see all of you around the table. Welcome. And hope you had a blessed Thanksgiving and can look forward to the holidays with joy. For our viewers, this is a meeting that is informational only, but we welcome your viewing us because we never get to be on television. The Policy Committee meets in a room that doesn't have television facilities, and we meet at 8 o'clock in the morning, so it's not likely that you have seen us before. So we are happy to have you viewing us this morning. Members, our agenda will begin with approval of minutes, so I hope that you have looked over those two sets of minutes from previous meetings. Representative Peterson Ross, will you move the March 26th meeting if you have
so moved?
Representative Peterson moves the March 26th meeting minutes. Are there any corrections or additions? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed, the motion carries and the minutes are approved for March 26th. And then we had a joint hearing on November 5th. Representative Christensen, will you move those?
Madam Chair, I move minutes.
Representative Christensen moves the November 5 minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, the minutes are approved for November 5. Well, we are gathered here today to hear the Civics Bill. The Civics Test Bill, which is authored by Representative Erdahl, and then to hear some updates from Commissioner Casalius, and we welcome her. I know she has a very busy schedule, and it's so great that she would take time out to give us an update so that we're more prepared when we resume in March of 2016. So with that said, I'd like to call to the table Representative Erdahl. Members, you do have a copy of the bill that Representative Erdahl introduced, 1497, and you also do have Ms. Larson's bill summary. So welcome, Representative Erdahl, and maybe we'd like to bring your testifiers forward at the same time.
If they wish.
I think we're going to have... Peggy Moon, who's the former state commander of the American Legion, and with whom I have served as an auxiliary member, and it's so great to have her here. And former national commander Dan Ludwig of the American Legion. So, Representative Erdahl, please begin.
Well,
say your name
you.
For the record and.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any credits you want to give yourself?
Well, that would take too long.
Oh, maybe just a tiny bit.
Just a snippet. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, Representative Dean Erdahl, and former social studies and civics teacher. And so it's glad to I'm glad to be before you today presenting what I feel is a very important piece of legislation that affects teaching and education in the state of Minnesota. For a moment, I kind of feel like I'm in a classroom again here. We'll start out with a video.
Well, Representative Erdahl, we'll try to be good students.
All right, thank you.
And pay attention and answer your questions. Members, there are handouts in your packet, so you can check those. There's the Civics Education Initiative with some facts and also some other information about the extent to which this test has been adopted by some states.
Okay, thank you, and with that, I will begin our little, I think it's a 3-4 minute video.
Tech. We're here on our home campus at Texas Tech to see just how much our fellow students know about their country. Let's find out if we're politically challenged.
Okay,
what is your name and major?
Leon V. Hill in psychology.
Jonathan Barnes, and I'm a sports management major.
Allison Eden, and I'm a pre-nursing major.
I'm Mitchell Johnson, and my major is human sciences.
Ryan, in clinical psychology.
I'm Marissa, and I'm a psychology major.
Who won the Civil War?
We did? The South?
Like, the one in 1965, or what Civil War?
Who won it?
Who was even in it?
Who was in it? Just tell me who was in it.
Ooh, I don't know.
Why are you making me do it?
Who won the Civil War?
Yeah.
Oh my god. Wait, I'm dying to blink. Some of those things. I feel like I'm on the Jimmy Kimmel Show.
America? I don't know.
That's the Confederates, right? I have no clue.
The Union.
The North.
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
So who is our vice president?
The North.
I have no idea.
Right now? I don't know.
What's his name? Oh my gosh. I have his name in my head.
Who is the vice president? Is that like a trick question? Okay. I don't know. I have no idea.
Don't know.
John. Joe Biden.
Yes.
I don't know.
You're not the only one. A lot of people don't know.
I still feel sweet.
Okay, who did we gain our independence from?
These are horrible.
I have no idea. Do you know what year we happened to?
Absolutely not.
I couldn't tell you.
So like 1677 or something like that.
And what show is Snooki on?
Jersey Shore.
What show is Snooki on?
The Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore.
Jersey Shore.
And then who is Brad Pitt married to?
Angelina Jolie. Angelina Jolie.
And who was he married to before that?
I think it was Jennifer Aniston.
Jennifer Aniston.
Awesome. Thank you.
Well, Representative Erdahl, did you do one of those around Minnesota?
I did a session in McDonald's in Litchfield on this.
Excellent. Please proceed.
Let's see. I think this is about the civics test. It's about the naturalization test that immigrants take before they become citizens. And I'll begin by just throwing out a few questions. To give you an example of what type of questions these are, out of 100 of them, what is the supreme law of the land? You don't have to. What is one right or freedom from the First Amendment? Name one branch or part of government. Who is in charge of the executive branch? Those are just a few examples of the types of questions that are given in this. I'll make a few brief remarks here, and then I have some testifiers to speak about this as well. So I'll now do the remarks, or as my students sort of said, the part is Erdahl unplugged is what they call them.
We welcome you.
Former Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor described civics education in Minnesota as a crisis. With woeful regularity, researchers confirm Americans' dismal knowledge of civics. In a nationwide poll, 77% of Americans between 18 and 34 couldn't name even one of their U.S. senators. Two-thirds of Americans can name at least one judge, an American idol, but only 15% the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. Two-thirds can't name the three branches of government, and one-third can name none of them. Public schools were established to teach civics so that we would have good citizens, the basis of our republic. But there has been a precipitous decline in civics education in our state and nation over the last 30 years. Why? There are many reasons, but I would like to concentrate today just on one. One of the greatest factors undermining high-quality civics education has been the growing emphasis on required testing in math and reading. Now, this is important, but it has come at the expense of civics learning. A student can be great at math problems or an expert in literature, but if students don't understand our republic and how our government works, all other learning doesn't matter because our republic is in peril. Immigrants seeking to become U.S. citizens are required to meet a minimal standard of knowledge about civics and government as a condition of naturalization. This bill provides that students in grades 7-12 must pass the citizenship test, that 95% of immigrants applying for citizenship pass before they graduate from high school. The requirement is happening across the country. 9 states have passed this measure, and 24 more are studying the impact of the decline of civics education in their states. The question should not be, do we have too many tests? The real question is, are we testing what we need and what we want to test? The impending reissuance of the Elementary and Secondary Education Act presents us with a great opportunity to test and emphasize what we believe is important. Under ESCA, one unintended consequence has been a narrowing of the focus of curriculum at the expense of civics. Members, this is about foundational knowledge. How will people know how to function in our government if they lack the building blocks of knowledge? There is a refrain in public education that schools exist to prepare young people for college and career. I submit it should be also college, career, and citizenship. Is this another test? Doesn't need to be. It can be and should be part of the civics tests now taken in Minnesota schools. Is it another high-stakes test? It could be viewed that way, but there is much flexibility. There is a 6-year window to pass the test. It can be taken as many times as necessary to obtain the passing score of 60%. And we did reduce some of our tests the last year. When I talk about high stakes, I'm struck with an example from basketball. If the score is tied and time has run out on the clock and you're at the free throw line and you've got one free throw to make to win the game, that's high stakes. But if the score is tied and you're at the free throw line and time has run out and you can shoot the ball until you make one, it considerably relieves the pressure. And that's basically what this is. Administration of the test can be done locally with much discretion. The test could be given all at once, repeated. It could be given one question a day. It could be given in sets of 33, 33, 34. That would work. It could be spread out over several grades. Just get 60 right out of 100 at some point. It is passed in 9 states, including North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin. 24 more states have introduced this legislation. And there are accommodations for those with physical or mental handicaps. And it's not about rote learning. It can and should lead to higher level learning. Of course, some memorization is not out of place in education. We memorize the periodic table, multiplication tables. My goal in presenting this is to help elevate civics education and engagement and participation in our system in Minnesota. Members, we all recognize that education is the key to knowledge and that knowledge builds the foundation of our lives, our society, and our country. Our republic depends upon the foundation of knowing how this country came to be and how it works. And I would ask, as we go through this process, that you support this proposal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Very well done. Welcome to your testifiers. And Ms. Moon, maybe you could introduce yourself and begin.
Be glad to. Madam Chairman and members of the House Education Committee, good morning. My name is Peggy Moon, and I have served as commander of the American Legion for the Department of Minnesota. Last year, 2014-2015, I am a Vietnam-era veteran, a member of Zimmerman American Legion Post 560 for 36 years, and the first woman ever to lead the Department of Minnesota for the American Legion in our state's history. So I'm very proud of the job that I had last year. And I'm here to lend my voice in support of the Civics Education Initiative, which asks that our Minnesota high school students pass the very same test that is given to new immigrants who want to become American citizens. I'm honored to serve as a member of the Minnesota Advisory Committee for the Civics Education Initiative. Other members include my friend Dan Ludwig, one of our past national commanders for the American Legion, as well as former Minnesota Supreme Court Chief Justice Kathleen Blatz, Olmsted County Commissioner Ken Brown, Stan Hubbard, Chairman and CEO of Hubbard Broadcasting, Vance Opperman, President and CEO of Key Investment, former Congressman Jim Ramstad, Mark Stetrud, founder and CEO of the Summit Brewing Company, and Charlie Weaver, executive director of the Minnesota Business Partnership. Before a new immigrant to this country can become a citizen, in addition to showing that they can read, write, and speak English, they have to pass a test on the basic facts of United States history and government. Over 91% of new immigrants pass that test on their first try. Unfortunately, the level of knowledge among everyday Americans and our own native-born high school students is far lower. According to a survey by the Annenberg Public Policy Center, only 36% of Americans can name all three branches of government. Worse yet, only 38% could successfully identify which party controlled the U.S. Senate or the House of Representatives. Informing and engaging the next generation of Americans on basic civics is vital to our survival as a republic. The people who favor this initiative all have widely varying political beliefs, but the one thing we all share is the belief that it's important for all Americans to know the principles of our constitutional government. We believe our children should not only be expected to have a basic understanding of the principles upon which our nation was founded, but they deserve to be armed with that information in preparation for their adult lives as they vote for representatives who will make those critical decisions about the future of our nation, our state, our local government, and our communities. The Civics Initiative is not the total answer, but I believe it's a good first step for both Minnesota and for the entire nation to ensure that every student is equipped with that knowledge. And I would hope that you would support it. For that, I thank you.
Thank you, Commander Moon. Commander Ludwig, please introduce yourself and begin.
Good morning, Chairman Erickson, members of the committee. Thank you for having me here today. My name is Daniel Ludwig, and I served as National Commander of the American Legion in 1995-1996. I served for 8 years in the United States Navy from 64 to 72 in a submarine Navy, and I also was a Navy diver. And I've been a member of the Leo C. Peterson Post 54, the American Legion in Red Wing, Minnesota, for a long time now. Eleanor Roosevelt once said, "Our children should learn the general framework of their government, and then they should know where they come in contact with the government, where it touches their daily lives, and where their influence is exerted on the government. It must not be a distant thing, someone else's business, but they must see how every cog in the wheel of democracy is important and bears its share of responsibility for the smooth running of the entire machine." Generations of American leaders, from Jefferson to Roosevelt, knew that informing and engaging the next generation of Americans on basic civics was vital to the survival of our republic. Unfortunately, 227 years after the signing of the Constitution, few American students understand basic facts about our government, its creation, or how it works. As the nation's largest wartime veteran service organization, the American Legion is committed to advocating patriotism and honor, promoting strong national security, and continued devotion to our fellow service members and veterans. In order to preserve these values in our youth and to ensure that our future leaders will continue to fight for them, we need to educate our children on the founding principles of our nation and the duties and obligations that are attached to being an American citizen. The Civics Education Initiative advances these goals by requiring high school students to pass a test on 100 basic facts on U.S. history and civics. These questions and basic facts that every American should know, the social studies equivalent of the multiplication tables. I believe a copy of the U.S. citizenship test was included in your committee packet, and I encourage you to take the test yourselves later today and see how you fare. But I thought I might mention just a few of the questions.
Bill, get them all right.
Yeah. On the internet you can take various samples. I took the 10 question test twice, and I'm proud to say I got 100% on all 20 questions. So some of the questions, what do we call the first 10 amendments? We elect the president for how many years? What is the highest court in the land? Who is the governor of your state now? Name one state that borders Canada. Hopefully the students and hopefully folks in Minnesota would shine on that one. As you can see, asking our high school students to be able to successfully answer at least 60% of these 100 questions correctly is not an undue burden. It is the least we can do to set a minimum standard for the civics knowledge for the next generation of Americans. On behalf of our American veterans who have made great sacrifices to preserve the many freedoms we all enjoy, I ask that you join us in support of this legislation to ensure that all high school students learn these important facts about our government, our nation, our values, and our responsibilities in order to promote active citizenship. Thank you.
Thank you, Commander Ludwig. And I know we have one question already. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and actually more of a comment, but I want to thank both of our testifiers first for coming, and thank you for your service to our country and fighting for many of the freedoms that are listed in this test. And Representative Erdahl, I want to thank you for bringing this forward. And I'm not a big one for mandating things on schools. We have important things to mandate. Tests, we want to make sure, be very careful what we're doing. But in this case, I think this is critical, and it's a good mandate. It's flexible. It's something that's already taught, so it shouldn't be a huge deal. And just to give you a little, a couple years ago, I was at my family Christmas dinner, and I sat at the table with our young people in our family, and for fun, I was giving them a little test. And I'm sorry to say that they couldn't even answer who our country fought against in the Revolutionary War. And that opened my eyes a lot, the necessity of this, because if we forget where we come from and our foundation, we will not have a country. And so I want to thank you for bringing this forward. I think it's important. It's a good test to bring forth for our state. And I sure hope other states follow suit along with the ones that already have and what we're doing. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bennett. In defense of our social studies standards, I know the commissioner will be happy to hear this, as should others. We have a strong section for civics in our social studies standards. It is one of the sections of the newly adopted social studies standards that I thought was very good. And beginning in kindergarten, I want to tell you that one of the benchmarks deals with symbols, which you probably would think, you know, that's typical. But the benchmark, so when the children are tested, they have to know the American flag, the Statue of Liberty. They have to know the Pledge of Allegiance. They have to know the Minnesota State flag. And then it proceeds through first grade, second grade, third grade, fourth grade. And then in fifth grade, it really gets into the nitty-gritty. So some of the questions that are asked on the sample test, which I have taken three times, I think, scored very well, begin to drill down. And so I think fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth is a little weak in my estimation, but the fifth, sixth, and seventh grades are strong. And if that's reinforced, which I don't think it is in high school, and you know that's part of the problem as a former teacher, reinforcement, and I know Representative Bennett would agree, reinforcement has to occur. So that students remember. I think those college kids were taken aback a bit. They probably do know the answers, but when you're put on the spot, even we adults sometimes flounder. But reinforcement is so important. And in the 9th through 12th grade, you know, the democratic process is enhanced. But these fundamental things are really covered in our social studies standards under the civics and government section. So I'm very happy that our public school students, both charter and regular public, and I'm sure our private school students and our homeschool students as well, are drilling down a little bit better. These standards began to be used in 13-14, so they're in the third year now, and that's really encouraging. I think we're getting closer, Representative Erdahl, to that 90%, or as Commander Moon said, that 91% who pass who are our new citizens. Representative Urusso, you had a comment or a question. Yeah, Representative Erdahl.
Somewhat supporting what you're saying, the National Assessment of Education Progress has done a survey, and they have found that in the primary levels, progress is being made. Eighth grade is flat, and there is a decline in senior high. And so, I guess the reinforcement is what we are lacking, and it's that senior high group that is going to become the voters when they reach 18, that we need to make sure we've reached and they know these things when they graduate.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I like the idea of making sure that our kids graduate knowing something about how government works. Sometimes when I'm door knocking, I'm kind of taken aback. So I like the fundamental idea. And we've talked before about some of the details, and I'd really like to work out some of the details. So my first question is, in your bill, you state that we're talking about the 100 questions that, as of January 1st, 2015, are chosen by the federal government. Do you have a plan for how we would update that? Because presumably these may change from time to time.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Russo, not as such right now. I don't have a plan for changing. The answers change the questions, like who's the president and things like that. The question doesn't necessarily need to change. But I think that said, that there should be room for flexibility, and we can work on that.
Representative Urusso.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to that point, when we talk about the questions that are on here, people have a tendency to pick out the good questions. There are a number of questions that are on the test that are more in the nature of trivia and really not about how does our government work. And those are the ones that always kind of give me pause. And one of the I understand this is a national initiative, so people don't want to tinker with the list because it's a national initiative. But at the same time, it should be a good test if we're going to have the test. And I do note that on the advisory committee, there are no educators on the committee. Also, there is nothing, because it's the national initiative, there's nothing in the test that reflects Minnesota government. And I'd like to see that. So one of my suggestions, if we work on this going forward, is can we pull out the ones that are just trivia and replace them with ones that would reflect some knowledge about Minnesota government? and I'd be happy to work on that going forward.
Thank Representative Riddell.
Thank you, Representative Urizo. And you know, today we're looking at the 100 questions, and you know, I think we should go forward to that with that, but I'm certainly open to discussion as we go along.
Representative Moran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to welcome the testifiers to the committee today, and thank you for your service also. So in listening to your presentation, I think first I want to start with what's the makeup of those who created these questions? I mean, is there diversity within the committee, the Minnesota Advisory Committee, or, I mean, what did that look like? Could you give me some background information?
Immigration test.
On Representative.
So this is part of the immigration test?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
So I was looking at question 8. And and question 8 for me is a little bit troubling. And it's based on someone's view, you know, about what Martin Luther King did. So the statement says he fought for equality for all Americans. He advocated change in government style. He argued for violent resistance, and he fought against racial integration. Can you tell me what's the correct answer?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you. Madam Chair, and I'm sorry, Representative Moran, which question?
8. Number 8. And what did Martin Luther King Jr. do on the
That's not my number.
The Civics Education Initiative, 100 Facts Every High School Student Should Know, the handout that we received. Do you have that one in front of you?
I don't think we have that.
We don't have that.
Okay.
Well, again, I didn't have that on the other sheet, but to me, the answer is A.
Representative Moran.
Madam Chair, and the testifiers, do you believe that's the correct answer?
What?
Also? Well, to the testifiers, do you also believe that that's the correct answer for 8?
Commander Ludwig? Yeah.
I agree. That seems to be the most appropriate answer.
Commander Moon?
All right. That's what I would pick as well as A.
Yeah. So, Representative Moran,
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. So my point is that often enough, especially when we have high-stake testing or testing in general, the answers are based on someone's viewpoint. I would think, you know, if I had to choose, I would change D and say that he fought for racial integration. That is what I would think his work was about. It was about, you know, including African Americans into the American dream, you know, fighting for equality, fighting for justice, so, and fighting for equal school, equal opportunity. So for me, you know, I think he fought for racial integration into our society.
And so,
Representative Erdahl and Madam Chair, you know, often enough, I heard in your statement that civic is about good citizenship, and I would say, I don't know if a person would not be able to answer all 100 questions, or even 60% of it, that they would not be a good citizen. You know, I don't really equate this, and I'm really happy to know that the history standards is now really including civic engagement. I think we should definitely have knowledge and information about civic engagement. I think it has a really important role in our educational system, but to make it part of high stakes and another mandate, another pressure that we are putting on our students or young people. I think it's a bit much. I definitely do agree that we need to know our civics, but I don't know if I can equate that if any one of those individuals in that video that we saw were not good citizens because they did not go.
Thank you, Representative Moran. You might want to make notation of that, and you could send it with Representative Erdahl, and he could convey that to
that's just one
to whoever creates the test. Representative Ward.
Chair, I'd like to.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please do.
Representative Moran, in question number 8, if it had said, what did Martin Luther King Jr. do? Fought for racial integration. I may have chosen that one, but doesn't it says fought against?
I know.
Integration.
I know, and that's I know.
So
I said exactly, but you know, yeah.
And also, I would say.
Matt is here. I'm sorry.
Also, I would say that the purpose of this is basically engagement of our population in government, and I believe that fundamentally one is a better citizen if one is engaged, but without knowledge, engagement is a tricky thing if you don't know what you're becoming engaged in. And again, regarding your high stakes, I think that there are plenty of things in this legislation that, as I said before, relieve the pressure of the high stakes. I believe that nearly every student in the state of Minnesota is entirely capable of getting 60 right out of 100 in this test under the stipulations in this bill.
And again, Madam Chair, I agree with you that civic engagement is important and needs to be a part of our children's educational learning. And as Representative Erickson made clear that beginning in 13-14, it is a really big part of the history that goes on within our school system. And it seems to be starting like really early in the process at kindergarten. So there is some learning, there is some engagement, they are becoming more informed around the history of America, United States of America. But I think my opposition is, again, to make it a part of high state testing and or a mandate that we have put upon our students. Learning is fantastic, but if it's attached, again, to the stress that so many of our kids are going through already, I don't think that that's the process we need to have currently within our school system.
Representative Ward.
Just disagree a little on that.
Representative Ward. Members, we have to be finished with this section of the hearing in 4 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will try to be brief and quickly. I also agree, I have some concerns about a good test. It is really hard to write good questions and have them get to what you're wanting. And one of the instructions that isn't here is to give us the best answer that is there. So I agree with both the comments and questions that Representative Yarusso and Representative Moran have given. I have a question about the logistics. So I'm assuming that this would be done electronically. So it could be, who's going to keep track of all of this unless we do it electronically? And if a student passes a test then or a question, they can keep building on that same test over time. But how just the logistics of that are a concern to me. I've got lots of other concerns as well, though you know that I support the concept and certainly the urgency to have our students informed as well as engaged in the process. So the logistics are a question I think hasn't been answered yet.
Yes, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, and thank you, Representative Ward, for signing on as one of the co-authors of the bill. And questions of logistics, I think, are legitimate, but I don't think they are at all insurmountable. the way I would view this, and I won't get into details today. I think that, again, it's not an insurmountable problem.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ward.
Just to follow up quickly, one of the reasons that I support this is that we need to have the conversation so that we can make it better, make the test better, make the process better. And I'm hoping that we can keep this moving along. Thank you.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Erdahl and testifiers, for presenting. And I think it's shocking that, you know, in the video, that's just a sampling of what we're seeing among our youth, and I also echo what Representative Urso said, hearing it at the door. People are not very aware of how our government works in it. So I support the concept of trying to find a way to get students more engaged and informed, as Representative Ward said, and she also mentioned the logistics, and just a couple things I wanted to throw out there that I'm noticing as I'm reading through the bill that you might want to think about. At the top of the second page, it mentions that a school district must record on a student's transcript that the student passed the civics test. Might be worded better if the student passed the test, not that every student would have that on their transcript. And then I'm curious to know more about it, you know, at a later point, how it would work, where it's talking about a homeschool student would only be required to do the test if they graduate from an actual school, and how would that be defined? And then also, I appreciate that it says that the students would not be charged to take the test, but then who would pay and how would that work? So those are some of the questions that I have that I think would need to be fleshed out.
Madam Chair.
Representative Erdahl.
This would be the last one. It would be part of the civics test given now by our schools.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Wills. Those were some good questions about the actual text of the bill. This is an overview, so we're not drilling down, but at some later date, perhaps, Representative Erdahl will take a closer look at the language in the bill and make some modifications.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I look forward to drilling down with you.
And thank you again to Commander Moon and Commander Ludwig for taking the time to come here. Thank you for your service to our country, and look forward to what will happen in 2016 in regard to this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, members, we're going to move to the other agenda items, which basically will be presented by Commissioner Brenda Caselius from the department and some of her staff. So welcome, Commissioner.
Oh, that's Representative.
Yeah, those are,
there we go.
And members, you have some historical documents that I had prepared for you just so that you can be reminded of what we're about to hear. Ms. Larson, in 2014, of September, that is, of 14, prepared among her short subjects the Federal Accountability and No Child Left Behind Act waiver. And there are two paragraphs in the middle of the front page that you may want to just review so you're reminded of our waiver from 2012 and the paragraph following it, what was required to receive that waiver. And then on the back side, I'm sure the commissioner will be in her presentation on the MMR referring to the proficiency index, the academic growth score, and the achievement gap measure. Then two historical documents from 2003, the state's analysis of student performance under No Child Left Behind and the adequate yearly progress. At the end of the commissioner's presentation today, she will make remarks about what she knows in regard to the reauthorization of the Elementary Secondary Education Act, which we do believe the Congress will complete in December or early January, and the President will sign. So welcome, Commissioner Caselius. We have a lot on our plate and on your plate, And I really thank you for taking the time to give us some of the highlights, the progress, the ups and downs of the MMR, the World's Best Workforce, and then finally the ESEA. Please say your name for the record and begin.
Brenda Caselli is Commissioner of Education, and I'm here with Stephanie Graff, who's our Chief Accountability Officer, who oversees federal programs, and then Ado Shuni, who is our Director of Government Relations. Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for having me here today. To give you an update, kind of where we're at in terms of results in Minnesota, then where we've been with the waiver, and now with the new ESSA reauthorization, it's going to be called the Every Student Success Act. Succeeds Act will be, I'll give you some updates on where that's at and how that's progressing in Congress. So currently, we have two statewide goals under our waiver that we received in 2015, which is to reduce the achievement gap by 50% by 2017. Took away the requirement of 100% proficiency by 2014, and we replaced it with this closing achievement gap by 50% by 2017, because that was really continues to be our Achilles heel, is to ensure that all Minnesota children have an excellent education regardless of race, zip code, or socioeconomic status or disability.
And members, you do have a copy of the PowerPoint,
yes,
that you see up there on the screen.
And
you
I'll try
have
to
that
go
in
quickly
your file.
Through this as an overview and leave plenty of time for questions.
Thank you.
Also is to reach 90% graduation rate overall, with no student group being below 85% by 2020. So some of the results, just quickly for all of you, so that you can see the trends. We've had a couple of new tests that we have put in place, and they're all online now and adaptive. They will be off grade level next year by state statute. Minnesota Comprehensive Assessments and Reading Proficiency, here's our trends. Since there was a new test in 2013, we can see that our scores did dip. This is common across the nation with the adoption of the ELA Common Core test. And so Minnesota adopted the Common Core in the English Language Arts, but they did not adopt the Common Core in the math. You recall, Madam Chair, that we reviewed math standards last year and decided to put that off because Minnesota, we believe, has very strong math standards currently. So in reading, we are seeing very minimal growth at this point. I think teachers are adjusting to the level of rigor, the lexile, the level of the complexity of the text, and then also the switch from more fiction to nonfiction in the assessments, as well as you don't just read a simple passage anymore and give the main character. You actually have to compare and contrast, make inference, and between multiple passages. And so it's a much more challenging test, and we've done some adjustments also on the cut score and what's needed to actually be considered proficient and the level of rigor there. So also then on our MCA math proficiency trends, those continue to show improvement since our new test in 2011. It's still a slight small improvement. We did see the dip originally, and now we're seeing the gains going back up again in mathematics, but certainly not to the extent that we would like to see in terms of our student growth in this individual student groups. And so we have taken a deep dive into our assessments in mathematics especially, our math standards team they've developed a document to show where students are falling below in our assessments, the average mean score in each of the benchmarks on the exam, and we're going to get that out to superintendents. We haven't yet gotten that out to school districts and teachers yet, because we're still trying to make the document accessible so that we can put that up on our website and get that out. But it'll be out soon, within the next couple of weeks, and that will be a good tool for schools to use to be able to diagnose where specifically on our assessment students are falling behind and we need to strengthen our curriculum. And that's new this year. Okay, moving on to ACT composite scores. This is no secret that Minnesota does very well across states that test over 50% of their students. We have been top of the list for 10 years running. What's also interesting, but we still have large gaps, is that our student groups, other than Asian, do better than the national average across on our ACT. However, we have not had as many students of color participating, but that has been increasing over the past 5 years. So we are very encouraged that we are seeing greater participation by students of color and poor students, and yet we continue to see the rise in test scores. Graduation rates are improving. Over the past 4 years, we've seen quite an improvement. All students have improved 4 points. American Indian students with 8-point increase, and Hispanic students with a 12-point increase. Asian students around 9% increase, and then Black students about a 10.5% increase, and White students increasing about 2.5%. So as we continue to see all boats rise, we continue to see student groups that have historically not graduated at the same rates as White students perform even faster, and that's how we'll get at the gap closure. So really good news on the graduation gaps that have been existing. This is a chart from Minnesota Compass. I want to give them credit. They actually combine all of the students of color into one super group, and then they can look at it. So this is a nice visual to show how the actual gap is closing since 2009. You can see we've been on this trajectory, and that continues. And we'll be releasing graduation rates, I believe, beginning of February. Should be coming out for the 2015. We're always 1 year behind. Then, under our accountability system, as you mentioned, Madam Chair, in February of 2012, Minnesota was one of the first 10 states to apply for and receive No Child Left Behind waiver. We worked with stakeholder groups to develop what is now called the MMR system and a focused rating system. It's a multiple measurements rating system, but it's very limited in its multiple measurements. It's really graduation and test scores, but it's how you slice and dice the test scores. What we did in 2012 was put in a system that measured growth, it measured proficiency, it also for the first time gave every school an achievement gap closure score, which looked at how fast your kids were growing compared to the state average of their counterpart. So for special ed students compared to non-special ed students, or free and reduced price students to non-free and reduced price students, or students of color to white students across the state level, which was a much higher bar to actually meet than rather right there in your high school or middle school or elementary school. And then what we did was change the yearly annual designation to designations every 3 years under our waiver to give schools time to actually improve, to implement new strategies. And so instead of every year designating new schools for priority and focus, which is our lowest 5% of schools, and focus schools are 10% of schools with the largest achievement gap, we designate those schools every 3 years. And so we'll designate again in 2017, pending what we do with the new ESEA reauthorization. So, but what we do designate every year are reward and celebration eligible schools. So we do want to find where those best practices are happening in our schools. And so reward and celebration eligible schools are identified every year. And that's our top 15% of schools that are reward and 25% below the reward status that are celebration eligible. They then apply to the celebration eligible schools apply to the agency. We look at all of the best practices that they're doing, and then we award some of those schools to become celebration schools. I just want to remind the members here that non-titled schools are not included in those designations, so only schools that are receiving title funding in Minnesota are held accountable and provided a designation. That also means that you cannot get a reward school designation as well. So one of the things that we could look at under ESSA is including all schools like we did for our World's Best Workforce legislation. So I'm going to move now to talking about kind of the state's accountability system, which is the World's Best Workforce system. In 2013, Representative Marquardt and the committees here passed legislation called the World's Best Workforce legislation, which really, I think, built a framework for coherence across the state around 5 key goals: kindergarten readiness, third grade literacy, high school graduation, career and college ready preparation, and closing of achievement gaps. And at that time, it was aligning all of the budgets and school districts around those five goals and expecting school districts to do strategic planning to align programs and budgets to be more intentional about those key goals so we could kind of all be on the same page and moving forward together as a state. And so we have been doing that. We've created a new template for that. Last year, the legislature required us to report to you who has and who has not done the world's best workforce planning. As of today, it's our deadline today. But as of today, we have 120 districts that have submitted their summaries, and we have about 480 districts and charters. So we have, hopefully they'll be coming in a flurry today in the inbox. But so far we've collected about 120. So currently I'm going around speaking to all of the superintendents in their regions. We've provided them a template, which you have in your packet, to make it easier for them to be able to turn it in, and also for us to be able then to provide you better information on what's in their plans, what are the strategies that they're doing, what are the best practices. I am also going around and meeting with the 40 schools, the 44 schools actually, that are reward schools, both 4- and 5-time reward winners. We have 30 schools that have received the reward school status four times, and we have 14 schools that have received the reward school status 5 times. And these have been just amazing, amazing meetings to speak to teachers, school leaders, community members about what's happening in their schools. And what's interesting, members, is that it's kind of the same thing in every school. When I ask teachers, what's working in your school? Why are you getting sustained results? And they say, it's the relationships. It's the family feel. It's how the teachers support one another. It's our excellent school leader who supports us in the classroom. It's great parents and family who come up and donate to our school and give their time and volunteer. And it's teachers understanding and knowing the standards and teaching them, but that's not the one thing that actually drives the work. So it's just really interesting to talk with them, and I invite all of you to come with me, and I have been inviting you when I'm in my area to come and visit with me on these reward school visits. They're just absolutely amazing. We'll be convening them tomorrow or Thursday for a filming of Most Likely to Succeed at Best Buy, and I believe that if we can build the synergy of all of these excellent schools, then that synergy will build out in each of the regions, and then they'll begin to share and talk more about all of the great work that's happening in some of our schools. So I wanted to share that we are now, I'll move to explaining you wanted to know about the multiple measurements rating, so I'll move to that. So the core piece of the system that we have put in place was the multiple measurements rating, and there's a lot smarter people than me who designed this system. Stephanie can speak to it a little bit more if you have more technical questions at the end. But it is a system that looks at proficiency, and that's built on setting targets for students around proficiency and closing the achievement gap by 50%. It's also built on growth, which looks at individual student growth compared with themselves. And their year-to-year progress against what their target progress is based on what is expected from a cohort of students that scored exactly like they did the previous year. The achievement gap reduction, which focuses on accelerating growth in those student groups and how fast those individual students are growing and then averaging that at the school level. And then being able to combine that. And then graduation rates, and looking at that for high schools. So you get 25 points in each of these areas, and so you wouldn't get the 25 for high school for elementary schools if you don't have a graduation rate, and that's how we calculate the MMR. Our focus rating is the two pieces, the achievement gap piece and the proficiency piece, but we only look at the focused student groups for that because we're specifically looking at achievement gaps with this measure. And so we're only looking at the 7 historic groups in the No Child Left Behind Act, which are American Indian students, Asian students, Black students, Hispanic students, free reduced price lunch, special ed, and English language learners. Now that ESEA is being reauthorized, we have an opportunity to make the system better. I know that switching things mid year or midterm for teachers becomes very challenging and difficult. And so we'll want to consider that. So we will be reconvening our stakeholder group. What are the aspects of the system that we like? What aspects of the system do we think we still need to make it even stronger when we build our accountability systems? And then how can we better align world's best workforce, federal accountability, and state accountability and the No Child Left Behind Act, which will be reauthorized with the Every Student Succeeds Act, called ESSA, over the next year. The department we don't anticipate, well, first of all, let me say that I think that the House is going to be voting on this tomorrow and the Senate next week, and then it will be on the President's desk after that. So we do anticipate that this is actually really going to happen. It is long overdue, and so it's definitely time to have some stability. We've been able to have some stability in Minnesota over the past couple of years and not have a lot of the difficulties of accountability systems that other states have experienced, because we've been able to, you know, do the waiver, which wasn't a whole lot different from the No Child Left Behind Act. And now with ESSA, really being able to have the opportunity to better this system moving forward with having groups of psychometrician assessment directors from across the state come together and share with us. It could be that, for instance, you wanted to put science into the new accountability system or social studies test, although, you know, we're forbidden from making a social studies test right now, but with the, you could have the social studies, or you could have science, you could have the other items. If you wanted to have some kind of different testing system, it would cost obviously millions of dollars to design new testing system, but that will now be left up to the states. They will just have to test students in grades 3 through 8 in math and reading, as well as science at the grade spans. So that means at the elementary, middle, and high school level, which we already do. But it doesn't preclude you from deciding to do other types of assessments into your accountability system. It will also require a college and career-ready indicator into your accountability system, and you will still have to intervene with the 5% lowest-performing schools and any high school that has less than a 67% graduation rate. So those are kind of the big provisions within the new ESSA. It provides a lot more autonomy to the state to decide how they want to do the accountability system and how they want to do their assessment system outside of requiring the grade 3 through 8 testing and ones in high school. So at that, I'll take your questions.
Thank you, Commissioner Casellas. That was very thorough. In regard to the MMR, as I have visited schools, and because you will be changing this, hopefully. As I visited schools, there have been questions raised, you know, especially in the area of mobility, on how you calculate the MMR, students coming in, going out, and if that's negatively affecting. So do you have any idea for how you will reconfigure a system as we look forward and take into account the homeless, the mobility, students who enroll later in the year or in a later grade if it happens to be at the high school level? Any thought about that?
Well, Madam Chair, that's dictated by the federal accountability system. So in the new ESSA, I haven't read the whole 1,300 pages, but I do understand that they are allowing for a few types of flexibilities within that. So I believe, and Stephanie, you can correct me, I think it's that you have to be in the school 50% of the time now under the new law. And right now we have an October 1 cutoff, so students had to have been enrolled at October 1 through testing window when that opens. And so that's the current practice. We could change that to that it's been 50% under the new ESSA law. Also, there's an exemption for high schools that I'm told is in there. I haven't quite read the language yet for our alternative high schools, looking at their enrollments And maybe being able to look at high schools differently in enrollment so that you look at the days of attendance and the most days that they attend between 9th grade and 12th grade could be that high school then could be assigned to, that student then could be assigned to that high school so that there's accountability for those highly mobile kind of kids who are credit deficient. I have to look at that language. I've just been told that that language is in there. I know our alternative schools have been looking for some type of reprieve around accountability, so we'll have to look at the language and decide. All of this information will be brought to the stakeholder group, and then they can decide which aspects do they want to change. You know, do they want to change the normative growth? Do they want to look greater on proficiency? Has the achievement gap measure been a good measure for us in terms of really trying to affect change around achievement gaps? Is that working? So I think it's kind of up in the air on what the stakeholder group would like to do.
Ms. Graff, would you like to comment on some of this because you're the expert in this area?
Well, I think the commissioner covered it. I just want to clarify. So under ESSA, we're seeing that a student has to be enrolled 50% of the days in the academic year for them to be required to be included in the accountability system. So if a student is not enrolled for at least 50%, they would not be included in accountability. They still would participate in the test. The data would still be given to the schools and to the teachers so they know how that student performs. We still would report that information on our report card. That would be a requirement. They just would be excluded from our accountability system, which would be the MMR or whatever our next system is under the reauthorized law. Right now, however, we have something very similar. So if schools are thinking that their highly mobile students are being included in accountability, that's actually probably unlikely. If a student is enrolling in a school after October 1st, they're not going to count in the MMR system. If a student is not enrolled in the school for 15 consecutive days, sometimes I hear about families that move down to Mexico for a month and then they come back, that student also is not included in the accountability system. So again, they take the test, the data and information, which is so important, is still given to the people that need it in the school, and we still report it, but it's not counted in MMR. And I do get that question a lot, so I'm glad you brought that up.
Also, Graff, will you introduce yourself for the record?
I apologize. Yes, Stephanie Graff, Chief Accountability Officer at MDE.
Thank you. Commissioner.
Madam Chair, also I wanted to point out that 95% of students have to also take the exam, and that is still a requirement. So in our accountability system, we'll have to account for how we want to hold schools accountable for that 95%. Currently, we hold schools accountable in that 95% participation rate that you cannot become a reward school if you test less than 95% of your students. And I'm not sure that that will still be acceptable to the department in their new guidance. It could be that they want to make sure that students are, that you're still testing 95% of your population and those scores are counting in your accountability system.
So, Commissioner, as I look at your latest data from the department on the continuous improvement school list and see some of those MMR percentages as well as those focus rating settings, to what extent do you think those will change under ESSA? Because, you know, in looking through it, and I was looking specifically at my districts, mm-hmm. you know, which are suffering, especially a couple of mine, what change do you expect?
Well, Madam Chair, that's up to us. That's up to the stakeholder groups and the state legislature, quite honestly. And we can make broad changes or we can make minimal changes. It really just depends on what we think the system has produced and has it been useful for schools, and it will be good to hear from schools. I hear both. I hear some schools saying that they still struggle trying to understand the MMR, and I have other schools where they're really digging into the individual growth data and looking at their students and how far those students have grown, and they understand Z-scores and all of those really statistical measures. They're just starting to get a grasp of it. So it will really be up to the stakeholder group on how we move forward.
And Commissioner, who will make up the stakeholder group? Is it the one that you used previously, or will it be new membership?
Madam Chair, it'll probably be a mixture of both. I think it will be good to have some of the historical perspective,
yes,
and the debate from those who were previously there and why they made the decisions they made at the time. They knew it wasn't a perfect system when they set it up, but it was a system that we needed in order to get that set up. And then as we've had kind of this fits of starts and stops with ESCA reauthorization, and the extension, the waiver extension, we decided, well, let's just leave it alone until it is actually reauthorized. Now that it really looks likely in the next couple weeks that we will have a reauthorized bill, we have a really great opportunity here in Minnesota to set our trajectory for the next several years.
And how does the world's best workforce play into this? Because the wording in statute, and you know, which all of our schools know, is all.
Yeah.
All students, and so to what extent is that going to play into this, and will that become part of a new rating system, or have you given thought to that, how that's going to figure into accountability?
Well, Madam Chair, I would like to see it aligned to the world's best workforce. We've been trying to get to just one plan for districts to do, one strategic plan that all schools in the state are accountable for, and that gives great local autonomy. In your package, you'll notice you have a couple of items there on examples. You have Redwood Area Schools. You have the Bloomington Area Schools World's Best Workforce Annual Plan. And you also have a report out by a local newspaper on Elk River, and how the Elk River's news has reported the hearing that they had to their community. I think this is so simple and easy for people to understand around these five goals. Everybody's working on the same, so when we do professional development, we're very focused on what we say are the things that are important that are going to move achievement around teacher quality and around third grade literacy and preschool and making sure kids are ready for kindergarten, all of those things in high school initiatives. So it really does provide for greater coherence. So in my personal opinion, and I will leave it to the stakeholder group to decide these things, I think that the world's best workforce provides a nice framework for us to move forward for our state's accountability system.
So, Commissioner, how will you use data, though, when every plan is a little different? How will you use that data as a statewide indicator of how well we're progressing?
Well, Madam Chair, even though the world's best workforce plans are locally designed and they have local measures like MAP testing or student learning goals and other types of measures that they have in there, most of them are also using the MCA test and reporting out their state exams. And so the legislative body could decide that, and I think they have said that MCAs do have to be used for the third grade literacy goal.
Yes.
So I think that, you know, you could decide to have those indicators be used in that. I would suggest that we still use growth as a big key measure because you want to be able to credit schools where they're getting kids further growth in their academics.
So, Commissioner, one last question. To what extent do you monitor, I mean, I know we're at the beginning stages of the world's best workforce, but to what extent will you be monitoring, because there is a punitive measure in statute about the 2%.
Yeah.
So, you know, to what extent are you keeping track and will you follow through with that 2% redistribution if a school does not reach goal?
Well, Madam Chair, that's where the rubber's going to hit the road, right? In 2017, when we get the plans, and that's why we've done this extensive outreach. We have provided additional data to school districts just on their district and how they have been closing achievement gaps. That's been something we've been doing. They already got their third grade literacy because of the literacy aid. So what we did this year was provide them a regional picture of how they're doing and how the rest of their districts around them in the region are also doing on all the five key indicators. And so that has been eye-opening for superintendents to be able to see that. We did that so that they could see where success is happening and they could share more across district lines. You know, in an open enrollment type of environment that we have in Minnesota, it doesn't breed good collaboration because kids can just leave your district and go to the next district. And so what I'm trying to do with these meetings is to talk to superintendents and say, it's better if we can collaborate together on where the success is happening. Share your expert teachers who are getting such good results with kids, and share those best practices across your hallways, across your schools and districts in the state. And so that's what we've been doing. And so we're going to continue to do that with the reward school visits. We're going to continue to do that with the regional centers. We're going to continue to give them this data that they've never gotten before, so that they can see exactly how many students they have to move and where their targets are, so they can see they're part of the overall state picture of moving the state. And so that's part of the plan to continue to do that, and that's part of the world's best workforce. As for the not meeting the goals, it does say in statute that it's progress toward meeting your goals. And so there's not a huge punitive, you know, if the district can show progress toward meeting their goals, then we'll probably make the determination that they're progressing. But there might be that there's not much progress with certain student groups, say in American Indian students, for instance, in a district that has a higher percentage of American Indian students. We then might say, well, why don't we look at your success for the future? Let's do a greater deep dive on that and the way that you're spending that funding, and let's look at partnering with you to better spend that funding. And so it could be a very small thing around third grade literacy, not the whole plan, or it could be something as simple as we need to help you move your American Indian students, so we're going to work with you and your school board to redirect funds for this purpose. I'm hoping that will feel very much like our regional centers of excellence work, which it's a combined decision. It's a collaborative effort where we're working alongside the school district, and they're already doing their own self-improvement and redirecting their dollars because they've already seen that they have more effort that's needed in a certain area. What I find is so incredibly heartwarming is the way that the superintendents are now embracing this world's best workforce plan and as a strategic planning tool, and the way that school boards are seeing it as a way to hold superintendents accountable and to be accountable to their public for the measures that the legislature has said are important. So I think that it's maturing. We're not there yet in every district. Strategic planning is hard. Being intentional around student learning is hard work. But I think we're getting there. And so I'd like to see any new system be designed around the really hard work I think superintendents have been doing around the strategic planning in their districts.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I hope that I can't imagine how much work this is going to be actually to collect all this, but I must be old-fashioned here.
No,
technology provides some easy avenues. But as I've talked to the superintendents of small schools, I think we really need to give a little bit more focus to helping them. Maybe the regional centers can be more involved, because sometimes those superintendents are also part-time principals. They can't go to those meetings that are called. I've recommended, you know, that they do some FaceTime or, you know, we figure out a system of Skyping or something, because they can't leave their schools to go to the regional meetings, and they really need that support. So, you know, and as I look through your reports, small schools are hurting the most,
yeah,
from my perspective, and, of course, our urban schools. Representative Dabney, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm impressed that you describe yourself as not being technologically quite there, but you apparently FaceTime. So, you know, that's good. That's good. Good morning, Commissioner. Thank you for your time this morning. You know, we've got a lot of positive trends, and I do believe that one of the challenges in Minnesota education politics is the debate tends to be shame-based. Mm-hmm. We're only willing to look at our shortcomings and not willing to look at and then build on our strengths. And I think in most parts of life, if you focus on and build on your strengths, you're generally better off. But we do have a reputation as a state for collecting an awful lot of data. And not always using it to our best utility. I do appreciate the work I had the opportunity to do with Mr. Uni and others in your department this year on bringing greater attention to homeless students. Because I think when we start to look at the gaps that are so persistent, mm-hmm, I'm more convinced that if we pull apart the data we have, we can then start to get the focus where it needs to be. 80% of the homeless students in the state are kids of color, and our greatest challenges are amongst kids of color. But there's also groups like foster students that I don't, foster care children, who I don't know that we're collecting the data on, but if you know, you apparently know the national data, I'm sure, better than I, that they're one of the groups that's buried in there in our student population who tends to have some of the greatest gaps. There are other groups, and these groups tend to be growing in their proportion in Minnesota's student population. I'm wondering what we can do to make that kind of data more available and more valuable to schools so that they can, so that we as a state and they as individual districts and individual buildings can better focus on where the greatest gain may be made for those kids in our state.
Madam Chair, Representative Dabney.
Yes. Commissioner Caselius. Thank you, Representative Dabney.
Representative Dabney, this is something that, you know, really we ought to be doing, and we just need to find ways to do that better and to find the kids. With foster students, it's about sharing the data across agencies and being able to identify and be able to support those kids better. So it's getting those types of agreements in place so that we can do that. So if we can, we'll try to do it. The other complicating factor is that sometimes those numbers are so low at a school that you can't have identifiable data, you know, because you don't have more than 10 students, for instance, in a school. So then you can run into, you know, FERPA laws and that sort of thing. So, but we'll do whatever we can to address that. I think there is something in ESSA about foster students. And I think it was Senator Al Franken that put something in there. So I do think there's some provision and language in there. I haven't had a chance to read that part of it yet. But there is something in ESSA about special populations, I believe, and foster children.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. And I do know, and I believe when it came through the Senate, Senator Franken may have worked with Senator Booker on a provision targeting both homeless and foster system children in the same amendment to the bill, and I too don't know, you know better more than I don't know what happened to that.
Still
in the
going through the 1,300 pages.
Better you than me.
Affected children too.
I guess I would certainly welcome any opportunity to work with your staff on what we can do to better use the data we have. My understanding is Minnesota's early warning system gives two reports over a student's K-12 career. Massachusetts gives 12.
Yes.
And I, you know, they're usually the ones that we're
emulating.
We're fighting for first and second and third place over. And there's one, I think, to use the chair's language, we could emulate on providing richer data to schools on who needs to be targeted. And yes, some of that may require greater data sharing with other agencies and other entities. But again, I'd welcome the opportunity to work with your staff on that. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Representative Dabney. Some good questions. Thank you very much. There are some in the audience, I think, who would like to... Representative Hirsu, you have a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just very briefly, as long as we're bringing up the subject of increasing how we, you know, different ways we look at the data. We know from data we've seen previously that if we disaggregate some of this data, for example, particularly for Asian students, we come up with a different look at what's going on. And you can really clearly see that if you look at the ACT results, where we lead the nation in every category except how our Asian students do. And it's quite reasonable to think that that is because if we were to break out our different groups of Asian students, we would get a much clearer picture there. So if we can find additional ways to do that, I think it would be useful to help schools make progress. Also to celebrate the progress schools do make in a more authentic way. And as long as if we do that for Asian students, it's most likely to be useful to also do that for our Black students, because we've got very different family experiences of people. So any means that we can come up with to do that might be useful.
Thank you, Representative Urso. Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Urso, I just wanted to mention, too, and thank the committee and the state legislature for your support of EL Learning. We went from 5 years to 7 years. And so I think we'll see over the next decade, students who have language barriers will better succeed in our schools because of that. So I just wanted to mention that and thank you for that.
Thank you again, Commissioner, Mr. Adosh, Ms. Graff. Oh, a follow-up, Representative Urso. I better keep looking at you.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I very much appreciate that. However, we do need to remember that, particularly in the case of our Hmong students, probably most of those students are not qualifying for ELL. Their families have been here a couple of generations, but they still face many challenges in our educational system. So,
thank you. Thank you. Thank you again.
Thank you.
And is there anyone in the audience who would like to come forward and make comments? Thank you. Mr. Patel. Welcome to our committee, and please say your name for the record and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Kent Patel. I am currently the president and CEO of a nonprofit applied research organization called Search Institute, but was previously at the University of Minnesota and before that in St. Paul Public Schools and Bloomington Public Schools. I appreciated the invitation to come down and just share a few thoughts with you on a very big decision that you have before you. I participated on the committee that helped make recommendations about what became the MMR, and I think the state in general and Commissioner Casales in particular deserve extraordinary credit for taking a leap when it was unclear that the federal government was going to grant any waivers for No Child Left Behind. It was a little like a running back who sees a hole and goes through that hole when you don't know if it's going to be open. We know subsequently many waivers were authorized, but we didn't know that any would be authorized. A number of us who are on the committee, though, realizing that No Child Left Behind, which I think did some very good things but had by this point outlived its usefulness and was doing more damage than good. In some ways, I think we can say it was intended to be the cure for the achievement gap, but in fact it was the diagnosis. Put together a proposal that, at least in my case, we saw as a transitional one. And my message for you here is, as you undertake and as the state undertakes the effort that the commissioner talked about to think about the next generation of a state accountability system in Minnesota, that we not take the MMR as the starting point. Now, that's a big deal because we do need consistency in this state. We know now the feds are switching and we face that challenge. We know that here in Minnesota, we had said we were going to have all students taking the ACT and the precursor tests, and then that went away. So we are all seized of the need to give schools consistency, but this is a critical moment to think deeply about the future of education and our schools. My concerns about what the MMR both was designed to be and has become are both too numerous and I think in some ways beyond the relevance at this early point. But let me just briefly highlight the reason I think that the MMR should not be the starting point for a new system by actually going back to the comments that were made by the expert reviewers who reviewed Minnesota's application for the waiver in 2011. So let me just give you 5 points. These are direct quotes from the federally required expert review of our application for the waiver. Quote, the proposed system of differentiated recognition, accountability, and support minimally meets the technical requirements. However, the panel has significant concerns that the expectations for raising achievement and closing gaps communicated through the MMR are insufficient. Second point. Status achievement accounts for a relatively small percentage of the MMR. In addition, the status achievement measures, the weighted percentage of groups that make AYP, itself incorporates growth. Since Minnesota is using a value table growth model in its AYP determinations, the panel is concerned that this results in too little weight placed on students actually meeting standards. Point three. Some panel members are concerned that the growth and achievement gap reduction indicators within the MMR are entirely normative, as opposed to communicating any expectation of growth to standard. Quote, point four, the fact that MMR points earned in the growth, achievement gap reduction, and graduation rate indicators are based entirely on a school's performance relative to other schools, as opposed to any defined target for achievement, means that the MMR itself does not communicate changes in an individual school's performance, only its changes relative to other schools. And finally, point five, these are my points. The document is on the website and it's voluminous. 6.5, the fact that MMR points earned in the Achievement Gap Reduction Indicator are based entirely on a school's performance relative to other schools, as opposed to any defined target for gap closure, means that schools could earn points in their category as a result of their gap stagnating or even widening, provided that other schools had less gap reduction. So these are some deep issues that I know late in this hearing are probably far too in the weeds to go into, but I hope that gives you a sense that from the outset, expert reviewers saw some deep issues that were deserving of more careful consideration than was possible at that time. We have this very, very unique opportunity to do that kind of thinking now, and I hope that you, and as the commissioner alluded to, the administration and the Senate will really seize this opportunity to think carefully about the future. So very quickly, what would I advise you to think about? Number one, prioritize simplicity. If this is actually going to be a system that's going to drive improvement, people have got to actually be able to understand it, including the nuts and bolts of how it's calculated. If any of you know people who work in higher education, you know they probably hate the U.S. News and World Report rankings of colleges that come out every year. But if you read the back of the U.S. News and World Report, you can quite easily understand how those numbers are determined. I think that's a standard we should think about here. Number two, think clearly about who the users of this new system are. If the answer is everybody, we're going to have complexity and chaos. So who is this state accountability system for? Point three, we've got to be able to tie however schools are placed in the system to specific bodies of academic content. The commissioner talked compellingly about going to visit the reward schools, and one of the challenges, at least in my experience with the MMR, is it's very hard to say, these schools are making progress on this body of content in math or this body of content in reading. In addition, finally, take a two-generation approach. The first generation are things we can measure well right now. And don't be aspirational in what we put in a system if we can't measure it well. It looks like the new federal law is going to give us flexibility to include things like measures of school climate or social-emotional skills or things like that. Many of us have been eager to see that happen for quite a while. Let's not put stuff in there that we can't measure, not just correctly, but also cost-effectively. But then let's also have a second-generation vision. Let's say this is what we can measure now well with fidelity in a cost-effective way, but here's where we want to go over time and build a system that actually can grow and flex as that work progresses. And then finally, I just really want to both commend the work that the state has done and the legislature has done. Let's focus on high performance. Let's focus on those schools that are actually getting the results, and let's try and really unpack why those positive things are happening so that we can start to get that sustained improvement at scale that I would hope a new system would be designed to create. So to summarize, you know, some of you may remember in a different context, and this is gonna sound more negative than I intended to, but I know how there's a weight of people having invested a lot of time and effort in a system. A number of years ago at the federal level, I think it was tied to welfare, there was the phrase, mend it, don't end it. Members, with great reluctance, I would suggest that if you have to place an emphasis on thinking about the MMR, you end it, don't mend it. Not because it wasn't a good decision when it was made, but because it's not the approach that I think can drive the kind of improvement that we seek in the years ahead. So thank you for that opportunity to share some thoughts here at the end of the conversation.
Thank you very much, Mr. Pickell. Are there any questions for Mr. Pickell? He's given us a really large nugget to think about as we move into the next session and work with the commissioner in a new system, we hope. Anyone else in the audience? Thank you very much, Mr. Pickell. And we look forward to working with you. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak? Okay. Well, members, this has been a great morning, and I wish you a very, very wonderful relaxation, enjoyment with family, et cetera, before we reconvene in 2016. And with that said, this meeting is adjourned.